Welcome to the latest United We Stand podcast of the season. My name's Andy Mitten, and I'm joined today by our special guest, our first female guest of this season, Kay Murray. Kay is a Middlesbrough girl. She's speaking to us now from Miami, and she's been working in Madrid for the last 4 years, so she likes working with places beginning with M. She hasn't worked in Manchester, although she did once go for a job at MUTV. Kay's a TV presenter for beIN Sport, and she only just moved over there. And I'd like to welcome you to the podcast, Kay.
Oh, thanks for having me, Andy. It's a pleasure to be on.
How's Miami?
It's absolutely amazing. It's like nowhere I've ever really spent time before. The new job's amazing. It's a new challenge for me. And then aside from the new job, my life outside of it's just great. I love my apartment. I love where I live. And it's just a whole new way of life.
People say it's very similar to Stockton.
Yeah, well, obviously I can see those comparisons, you know. I mean, people live there and drive there, that's about it.
And the sea's nearby.
There you go.
What do you miss about Middlesbrough?
What I miss about Middlesbrough is the banter and the people that I've used to being around. Like, I think there's a kind of sense of humour, like there are in so many places, especially up north, where, you know, you all get one another, and it's a very specific and very distinct sense of humour. And I miss how down-to-earth the people are and how they really live for the moment. People earn a lot less up there, and they kind of, they'll pretty much spend all their money going out on the weekend and looking nice to do it. And I love that mentality of, you know, dressing your best, and there's a real nice family feeling up there. And I think there's a real spirit from the people of Middlesbrough, you know, we're built on steel, and it's like we're all made of steel. So many people criticise the town without knowing it. And it's been the town that's found it hardest to come back from the crisis. It's, you know, I've seen friends losing jobs, teenage pregnancies always high there. But despite all these problems, you know, it's just a really lovely place to be. And the people are so resilient that just, it's like they can bounce back from anything. You know, football's just part of growing up there. And it really set me up as the person I am today and as the football fan I am today, growing up in a town like Middlesbrough.
So you were a Middlesbrough fan for as long as you can remember. What are your earliest memories of watching the Borough?
Getting a squeeze in through the turnstiles with my grandpa. Like, that's who, basically, my mum's dad was just somebody who we all really admired and looked up to in the family. So the reason I'm involved in football is because we'd find anything to kind of get his attention. So because he loved talking about the football, I used to just sit and listen to him. So he started taking me to the games. And yeah, I used to get a squeeze in, and I remember standing on the terraces at Ayresham Park. I remember, actually, this is quite funny, Clayton Blackmore's testimonial.
I was there.
Do you remember that? I was there for that.
I was there. I tell you what I remember about it was the Tannoy announcer. You probably know him or know who he was. And he made a point to the Middlesbrough fans. He said, because loads of people had turned up because it was Manchester United, and he wasn't having a go, but he said, you can come and watch us next week when we play a normal league game if you want.
That doesn't surprise me, but I can't remember it. But what I do remember is, because Manchester United were coming to town, my childhood sweetheart lived opposite Ayresham Park. His parents' house actually looked over it. And my parents actually let us bunk off school to go and queue for the tickets for that game. So we did that morning. I think we both got notes written saying that, you know, we couldn't go to school, but it's because we were queuing for tickets. But my mum had queued for tickets herself as a kid when George Best came to town, so she said she understood.
Wasn't there a pub called The Moon close to Ayresham Park?
There might have been, but at 14, despite what people say from Middlesbrough, I wasn't drinking pints back then.
Because Middlesbrough's fanzine's called Fly Me to the Moon, and I always got told it was because there's a pub close to Ayresham Park called The Moon. When I used to go to Ayresham Park as a United fan, it was pretty scary. It wasn't.
Do you not know why it's called Fly Me to the Moon?
I thought it was the pub.
Bruce Rioch, yeah, was once asked in an interview about his players, and he said, if I had to fly to the moon, I'd take my captain with me, Tony Mowbray. He's a magnificent man, and I'd have him with me wherever. So that's why they named the fanzine Fly Me to the Moon. But I know Rob Nichols from the fanzine, and the funny thing is there used to be a guy working there, I'm not sure if there still is. We had him on a show on Borough TV, and he was called Stuart Downing, and I was like, I bet you use that one when you go to Tall Trees nightclubbing, getting you into the ad list and the suites.
And Tall Trees, that was good in the early 90s. That was a house club.
Yeah, no, I loved it. I was there even when I moved to London. I moved to London at 18, and we used to come back, me and my best mate Faye, for every single retro night, which happened at Tall Trees, and we'd have all our new clubber on from London. We thought we were the absolute cat's pajamas, let me tell you. But there were great days back then. You used to I remember when once Paul Ince and Paul Gascoigne were there, and they actually put it over speakers at the nightclub, Paul Ince and Gazza are in the house, and everyone's cheering then and looking for them, but nobody could find them.
And is that's in Yarm, where a lot of footballers used to live and still live, although not as many as when Middlesbrough were doing as well as they were.
You say live, although it's quite funny because loads of them do, Mendieta ended up settling there, and Gordon McQueen, obviously they came down from Scotland and they settled up there, but Gary Pallister's there, so you always see these faces when you're out and about. But it was funny because when Robbo was around, there was this whole drinking culture with the borough, and it made the papers. But it's because he had such a great relationship with the players, perhaps too pally with the players than a coach should have been with their players. But it was brilliant because he used to be having some boozy lunches with the players in Yarm. And I always remember we went to a party of Curtis Fleming's years ago. Can't remember whether it was a birthday or something. And it just hit the papers that the Middlesbrough players had been drinking in the week. And, they had to cut down and there'd been a ban on their alcohol. But they were all drinking what we thought was Coca-Cola that night, but it wasn't. They were having Coca-Cola with shots of Jack Daniels or whatever in it. But they knew that if it was Coke, nobody would be able to tell.
I spoke to a few Middlesbrough players who played under Robbo, and they said exactly as you said. And I went to Yarm to see Gordon McQueen and to Gary Pallister's house. He lives just outside of Yarm. Gordon took me in the Black Bull, is that right, for the day?
Yeah, the Black Bull, I think Gary Pallister's the king of the Black Bull.
Yeah, well, Gordon said, before we do the interview, let's just have a few to warm us up. So 4 pints later, he took me to a restaurant 2 doors down. And by the end of it, I had to get back to Manchester, and his wife picked us up from the pub and she said, "Gordon, you've been drinking." And he said, "It's close season, love." She said, "Yeah, but you retired 18 years ago." He said, "That doesn't matter." And she took me back to Yarm Station, and it was great to see him last year because he's had a few health issues, but he was on really good form. And he tells some of the best stories I've ever heard about football.
Obviously, with Hayley being one of my best friends, and I'm very good friends with the whole of her family. And we were on holiday with them in 2009. And we were down in Estepona, down in Marbella. And Gordon's stories, I was honestly just thinking, these are some of the best football stories I've heard. And believe me, it's always the ex-pros who have the best stories. But his stories were so funny. It was just a privilege to hear them all. And I don't think hardly anyone spoke at the table for the rest of the night while we listened to the big man telling us all his old stories.
He's brilliant. You mentioned Hayley, Gordon's daughter. She's doing well as a presenter on Sky. She was at MUTV as well. There's another female football journalist, Claire Bloomfield. That's 3 of you from quite a big town or a small city.
Yeah.
What is it about Middlesbrough?
I think, first of all, the fact that it's just instilled within you. It's normal to be, it is in Spain, it's normal to be a girl and go to the football. It's just a normal thing in Middlesbrough, you grow up on it, so it doesn't matter. It's not a boys' sport particularly, and it's just seen. You see women all the time at the Borough Games, and I think that's part of it. And then I think that just because it's kind of, we chat a lot as smoggies, and it's kind of like if you get on the bus in Middlesbrough and there's an empty bus but one person sat on a seat, you'd probably sit on that seat next to them and have a chat to them. So I think that because we're just dead chatty and like that and down-to-earth people, and then we're brought up on football, it just seems to work in the sports journalism field, because it's all about, making contacts, being able to have the gift of the gab and actually knowing your sport. And I think that's what surprises a lot of people, how much the girls can hold their own when it comes to talking about football. So it doesn't surprise me really that there's a few of us coming out of there.
It's certainly not a rugby town. What's a Parmo?
What is a Parmo? Great question, Andy, but you have got to try one. You know, it's like tasting is believing. Basically, it's an escallop of chicken or pork, and it's covered in bechamel sauce like you get on lasagna, breadcrumbs, and then on top of that there'll be parmesan cheese and cheddar cheese and garlic sauce. It's just like roadkill, heart attack in a big box. So you don't get a pizza, you get a Parmo, and it's over 1,000 calories, every Parmo. And it is absolute heaven in a box.
When do you have one? After a club?
After a club, that's when most people have them. But now they're trying, like, you know, they try and make it a bit posh. So in some of the nicer restaurants in Middlesbrough, you can actually go and get a Parmo. But the best restaurant is one that's open till the very early hours of the morning called the Europa. And you go and get your Parmo there. But I took a friend from Ireland to Middlesbrough not long ago. And he managed a full Parmo on his first try, because you can get a full and a half. And honestly, it was like a merit for him. So when we went to the pub afterwards, I was telling the borough lot, I was like, he did a full Parmo. And they were like, oh, well done. Like shaking his hand, you know, it was kind of, that was it. He was integrated into the town then after managing a full Parmo on his first attempt.
What if you go out in Middlesbrough and you're single and you meet someone and you say, do you want to come back to mine? Is there a point where you both agree that you're going to stop for a Parmo?
I don't even think you need to have that agreement. I think that that's, you know, the unwritten rule. You just know that's going to happen.
What are your highlights as a Middlesbrough fan? Because the club you started watching at Ayresome Park was very different to the club which it became under Steve Gibson. They moved to the Riverside, they had success, they had great players like Janino. I can remember going there several times with Manchester United, watching Manchester United win the league in 1996. And United fans sang a song about being down by the Riverside. So Middlesbrough brings back happy memories. And also the 1992 League Cup semi-final, we played against Middlesbrough and went up to Ayresome Park. And do you know, there's a really anorakish stat, but more coaches went to that game at Ayresome Park than any other game in the history of Manchester United. And that's because 107 went. That's because you couldn't get there by train without it being really dangerous. And the police just said, go on a coach, otherwise you're going to have real problems.
Right.
How have Borough changed?
Well,
just asked you about, I just said about five different things there, didn't I? And at the end of it, I don't know what to say to you.
My expert, you know, I'm taking it all in. Well, Brian Robson changed everything. So even though, you know, there were some bad times under him, and without him coming, I don't think Middlesbrough would have been what it was today. But, you know, all credit to, and I stand, I'll argue with anyone at this point, Steve Gibson is the best chairman in football. That's that. And, you know, somebody, one of the best stories I've heard, first of all, is that Steve Gibson and Chris Kamara were good friends as kids. And Chris Kamara said, you know, he was a promising young footballer, and he said, one day I'm going to play for the Borough, Steve. And apparently Steve Gibson knew he wasn't so great with his feet. And he said, one day I'm going to own the Borough, Chris. And I love that, because he is a true fan. But Robbo came in, he was managed to attract these big names as well. Before Brian Robson came in, all those kids were walking around with, like, you'd have your, you know, your top flight side, you'd have an Arsenal top or a Manchester United top or a Liverpool top. After Brian Robson came in, everybody was wearing Middlesbrough tops, and there was this real pride to be a Middlesbrough fan. And, you know, the names that he attracted, and I'd never seen anything like it. Janino coming to play for us, you know, seeing that live, that it's the best player I'd seen at that point. I couldn't believe what I was seeing with my own eyes, like live. And so he changed everything in that way, and really did put us on the map. And I think a lot of people need to remember that. But my absolute pinnacle as a Borough fan was the Carling Cup final against Bolton. And it was this real weird state of delirium, to be honest, because we scored two so early on. And then when they managed to score and get one back, it was just this awful wait to see if we could hold out. So actually watching the game wasn't that enjoyable. But then when the final whistle went, it was just out of this world. When I used to get a little bit drunk, I used to still put the DVD of that 128 years later. Obviously, it's the only cup we'd won in 128 years. But there was this really strange feeling as well, because as soon as the celebrations were over at the Millennium Stadium, I just wanted to be back in Middlesbrough. I just wanted to get on a helicopter and be back in my hometown celebrating, because when we'd been promoted back in 1998, I remember, like, we were all out in the streets dancing, and I remember being stood on a bin, like, cheering. And it was just such a great atmosphere back in our hometown, because everybody just loves the football. That, you know, I don't know who won that day, whether you won if you got to be at the stadium and witness them winning it, or whether being back home and watching it on the telly was actually better, because then you got to celebrate with everybody from Middlesbrough in Middlesbrough. So I think that, you know, that day was kind of the best I've had as a Borough fan. But it was also like a kind of bittersweet measure, like of mixed emotions.
There was a time where you bought several former Manchester United players in. People like Clayton Blackmore came in along with Brian Robson. Did you ever have a soft spot for United?
I did. It's it wasn't even to do with that. I don't often tell people this, you know. It was more to do with when I was growing up, when I was about 12, 13, they were just dominating and they were just amazing. And, you know, you had like the, remember the song they brought out, and everybody at school loved them. I had stickers on my school books of like, I don't know, like it was when like Steve Bruce was there and Pally and Lee Sharp, Ryan Giggs, and I just thought they were amazing. And I'm still most proud on Twitter that Peter Schmeichel follows me. That's like my proudest moment on Twitter. You know, there are a few big names I've met in the business and a few big names that are following me back, but Peter Schmeichel was like, yes, I did it. So I do have a bit of a soft spot for Manchester United. But other than that, it's the fact that it doesn't matter if you hate them, and it doesn't matter whether you're a complete football neutral, but you love the game. Everybody wants to watch them play because they always come out to play. They always play attacking football, and you'll always be entertained if you're watching a Manchester United game. And it was like when I was at the Ballon d'Or ceremony last year, Sir Alex Ferguson got the award, and he even said, you know, that the one thing that they've always done is that they always play to win. So, and it's true, it was everything he was saying was right that night.
You say Ryan Giggs was there, he still is there.
I know, it's unbelievable. I was on air with my co-host the other day, who was a big Man U fan, a Scottish guy, an ex-player out here called Ian Joy. Like, he played in the MLS, he played in the German League. And we were just laughing that we were still at school with, and we're like in our early 30s, but when we were still at school, we had stickers of Ryan Giggs on our school books. And we're like putting his goal on the other day, going, there you go, that's Ryan Giggs, 21 seasons. Like, just unbelievable that he's still going. But just, there's a few veterans in the game today that we're still getting to celebrate. We saw Totti scoring and with Roma against Juventus the other day. And we're really honoured to be seeing the likes of Totti and Ryan Giggs, you know, still playing at the moment in the game. But, you know, it's a brilliant for Britain that we've got someone like Ryan Giggs still doing so well.
And you mentioned Schmeichel. I always thought it was hard work when he played for United. I never doubted him as a goalkeeper. He was brilliant. But of the players who I got on with as a journalist, I thought he could be hard work. And a lot of his teammates said that as well. But this summer, I went to Oslo where Manchester United were playing, and I got to meet him properly and to sit down with him, and he was fantastic. He was completely different to how I'd recalled him being 15 years ago. And I think some players, they just change, they grow up and they become more mature. But he was asking all about United We Stand. He was asking about away matches. At one point, he got on a stage with a guitar and started singing United songs. So I thought, ah, this is the type of personality which I'd rather know than the guy who could be moody and difficult sometimes. You mentioned the Ballon d'Or. You've presented that for the last couple of years, but before we get to that, you left Middlesbrough at 18. You went down to London. You're a trained journalist, that's right?
Yeah.
What did you go to London for? To study?
I went to London because I just wanted to get away from Middlesbrough at the time. I wanted to go and see what was out there. And I was in a girl group, actually.
Right.
People don't know, but I'm not going to be singing for you.
what were they called?
Shy, S-H-I-Y.
Did you have any songs which anyone might remember?
No. And even, you wouldn't want to, believe me. So I'd gone down to do that. And then the irony was, I'd gone to kind of seek my fortune in London.
The streets paved with gold and all that.
Yeah, it was. That's what I heard. And then when I got down there, after a couple of years there, the job at Middlesbrough TV came up, Borough TV, because I became the official Borough babe, like the face of the club. And but I was using it, knowing it was a way to get me into a media career. And luckily, while I went to do one of my photo shoots, the guy who was at Borough TV, the executive producer, used to be a guy that lived a few streets down from me. He was older than me. And like, I was chatting to him about how my family were doing, and I said, he said, so is this what you want to do, modelling? I was like, no, I want to be in football television. Because when I was like a kid, you know, we didn't see all the women in TV in football television that we do now. And then when I was about 18, 19, I started to, you know, you started to see the likes of Kirsty Gallagher and Gabby Logan popping up. And I was like, wow, so I can actually get paid to talk about football. This is brilliant. And so I told him that I really wanted to, you know, be given a shot. And he let me come in for 2 weeks' worth experience. And I just absolutely bombarded him with ideas. He said he'd never heard a girl talk about football as passionately as I did. And at the end of that 2 weeks, they said they had a show in the pipeline for a while. They wanted to pilot it with me, and it was a success, and Soccer Surgery was born. So I left for London, but the irony was I ended up keeping my flat in London, but travelling back every other week on the week of a home game to write, produce, research and present this show, Soccer Surgery.
So you went from Middlesbrough TV to Real Madrid?
Yeah, in the end. I mean, it was like I worked on a newspaper in between, and I even worked on the Selly Telly while I was studying journalism.
On the what?
So shopping telly.
Okay.
Listen, if you want me to sell you a kettle, Andy.
Right. So you're the...
It'll be hook, line and sink. You'll be a sucker. I know exactly how to sell kettles.
Go on, how'd you sell a kettle?
No, listen. I'll send you a link one day.
But if someone's listening to this podcast and they're considering buying a new kettle and you've got 400 to sell, how'd you sell one?
It's all about the vocabulary and making them laugh in the meantime.
But it just boils water. It's a kettle.
No, a kettle doesn't just boil water, Andy. You know, it's an essential part of living, especially as an English person. You go home, you need a cup of tea. You're bringing someone back for a cup of tea. You talked about going back. If you meet somebody in Middlesbrough and you go back for a Parmo, imagine if you've got a dodgy kettle. When tea's such a staple, especially in a northerner's diet, it's not going to work, is it?
So you meet a lad in Tall Trees, you say, here's what we're going to do now. We're going to go and get a Parmo, and I'm going to go back and I'm going to make you a lovely cup of tea with my new kettle bought from the shopping channel.
The best tea you've ever had in your life.
So you, from shopping channel to Middlesbrough TV, you worked on a newspaper. What were you doing on the newspaper?
I was working as a reporter, so I was doing our local government, and I was very close with the police in Haringey. I did all the stories, the big stories back then. Went to court and covered some of the big cases.
So you've been a proper journalist. You've done court reporting.
Shorthand's 100 words per minute.
That's better than mine. I got 90.
And my best, the thing is Bobby Robson got me that job. That's like, you had a 3-day trial. Once you'd passed like tests and the like on the newspaper, they brought you in to see how you'd work for 3 days with them, and that's how they decided who they were going to employ. And on the third day of my trial, I was just about to pack up and leave, and the deputy editor said, you need to go down to Brent Cross, so Bobby Robson's there. And I started laughing in his face, because Bobby Robson's my idol. And I thought my ex-boyfriend at the time, who was like a local lad, his family all bought that paper. I thought they'd called to make a joke saying, tell Kay on her last day that she's got an interview with Sir Bobby Robson. Because, you know, why are you sending out someone on trial to go and interview Sir Bobby Robson? So I started laughing at him, and he was like, what's so funny? You need to be there. We've not got any time with him. You need to get an interview with him. He's there signing copies of his book. And I realised he was serious. So I got down there and I was so scared. And I remember I'd not had my first paycheck then. I don't even think I had money in my current accounts. So I ended up buying the book with a cheque, thinking I'll get my mum to put some money in my account, and just so I could get in the queue to get it signed from him. And then when I got to the front of the queue, I just tried to, like, I said, oh, look, I'm on a 3-day trial for a newspaper, and they've sent me to interview you, and I don't know who to speak to, who your PR is. But luckily he heard my accent, and he was like, where are you from? And I said, oh, I'm from Middlesbrough. And he said, and how long were they hoping you could have with me? And I said, well, they said 5 minutes would be enough. And he was like, 5 minutes, we'll make it half an hour. Sit down, pet. And he gave me the best interview. I left walking on air.
Brilliant.
And I went home afterwards, wrote it up, and they said it was just amazing. And that interview got me the job. But last year I was in Malaysia covering the Euros with Astro Supersport, like their big broadcaster out there. I was co-host for the whole event. And Paul Parker was one of the pundits, and he had some brilliant stories as well about Sir Bobby Robson. So it's just like, that's the best person I've ever interviewed, and I'm so glad I got to do it before he died, because I was absolutely heartbroken that day, as most football fans were.
Paul was a guest on this podcast 2 weeks ago, so we spoke to him from Singapore. So he was in good form.
I absolutely love Paul Parker. He was like the highlight of my time. I mean, I had such a good time in Malaysia, and such great people out there. It's unbelievable, because in Malaysia I'm more known than I am anywhere else in the world. So like, you'll be in a restaurant eating, but because they love football so much, if you're on the channel that has the rights, you know, everybody knows who you are because nobody's not watching the Euros.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's good.
And I was out with Viv Anderson as well out there. There's loads of them. I had such a great time with all of them, a really, really good time. But I can't speak highly enough for Paul Parker. He's like kind of the Victor Meldrew character where he's always complaining about everything, but he knows that there's this slight humour in his complaints and he makes us all laugh because nothing ever, like, nothing impresses Paul, and I love that about him.
You mentioned Bobby Robson. In December 92, Manchester United played a friendly game in Lisbon to mark Eusebio's 50th birthday. It was the first game of Eric Cantona for Manchester United, and about 200 United fans went over. And the day after the match, we went to sport in Lisbon's ground, just me and three or four of my mates. And we turned up at reception and we blagged the receptionist that we'd come to see Mr. Robson because he was manager of them then. And we were like 17, 18, 19. And she thought that we had a meeting with him, and he came down to meet us and he spoke to us and he was really good with us. And then he called his assistant and his assistant showed us around the pitch. And I'll never forget that he had time for us. His assistant was a lad called Jose Mourinho. He'd been brought in as a translator.
I wonder what he's up to now.
I know, he's quite ambitious, lad, isn't he?
Well, my interview with Bobby Robson was during the time when Mourinho was still Chelsea coach, and I asked him about it. And, you know, he let out this lovely little chuckle, and he said, oh, he's just what this league needed. He's just what he needed. And so when I did my first interview with Jose Mourinho, when he was newly appointed coach at Real Madrid, at the end of the interview, you can see on the video that I passed something to him, and it's a copy of that interview, and he said he was, like, really appreciative of it. But Bobby Robson spoke very highly of Wayne Rooney as well back that day too, saying that he's the biggest talent that English football have got and he loves to watch him play. And I was lucky enough to meet Wayne last year, and even though he's very shy, he was really lovely. I had a bit of a joke with him and said, thank goodness you're here, because it was at the Ballon d'Or ceremony, because I said, I feel outnumbered by all these foreigners, but finally there's an English person here. So he had a little bit of a giggle with me.
And you also spoke to Sir Alex Ferguson ahead of presenting the Ballon d'Or.
Well, yeah, and the thing is I'd seen him ahead of it and I'd been a little bit intimidated by him, not for anything he did, but it's just Sir Alex Ferguson. And, you know, everybody wanted a piece of him and was chatting to him. And then at the very end of the show, we were actually on stage and we have to all get together for a group photograph. And he made a bit of a beeline to come over to me. And he said, I was reading the programme and, you know, it says that you're an English girl and you're out reporting in Spain for Real Madrid. And I was really shocked that he'd even, like, seen in the programme this, what I was up to. And I was like, yeah. And he said, that's brilliant. Good for you. And I actually couldn't believe it. I was like, oh, wow, thank you so much. He was like, no, that's a real merit. Good for you. And so how did that come about? And he was, like, really interested in how it all happened. And I said, look, Sir Alex, I just need to go and get rid of my microphone and everything. And I'd really love to get a photograph with you. And he laughed in this lovely way as if, like, he couldn't believe that I would even want a photograph with him. And honestly, like, it left, for someone who's known to be a very scary manager and, you know, especially with journalists, it really left a great impression on me that he actually came over to congratulate me on my, you know, on the fact that I presented it and the fact that I was from England and doing that. And I just, honestly, I couldn't speak highly enough of him, and that really did stay with me.
So how did the move to Madrid come about, and what was it like? Was it daunting? How was your Spanish when you moved over?
My Spanish was awful when I moved over, but I'd studied it at school. But, you know, at school, you're like, un café con leche, por favor, y voy a quedar en este hotel. Like, that's about it. You know, I'm going to go and stay in this hotel and I want a coffee. So just 10 years later and I move out there, it came about. They always say, you know, it's not what you know, it's who you know, and it's a little bit of each for me, because basically I went for the job originally and didn't get it, and I'm usually not bothered by knockbacks like that working in an industry like I do, but this one really hurt, because I thought, I have a tiny bit of Spanish, I'm a trained journalist and I know loads about football, I've already worked at a club channel, how could I have not got this job? But luckily, one girl who I knew, I didn't know her that well, she did get it. And she worked at the shopping telly where I worked. We weren't even on this. There was two channels. She was on a different channel, but we shared a dressing room, all of us. And when I heard she'd got it, I got her email of someone and congratulated her. And she said, I saw your name on the list. I can't believe you didn't get it, because you're the girl that we all know is the girl who talks about football. I tell you what, if anything ever comes up, I'll give you a ring. And I thought, yeah, everybody says that. Lo and behold, 6 months later, job position came up, and she put my name forward. She'd already got another guy in who I knew a bit better working there, and he vouched for me as well. And it kind of was a few back and forths, and then I finally got it, and it's made me, now she's one of my best friends. I was at her wedding last year, and it's really changed my attitude to a lot of it. I help as many people as I can, you know, I try and pay it forward, because I'll never forget that she did that, because so many people tell you they'll help you out. And she really did, but you know, once you've got your in, it's what you do with it, and I just made sure that I really worked hard. I came in at a very entry level. I'd already done a lot of live TV, and suddenly I was back behind the scenes writing and doing all the news pieces for Real Madrid. But I then became the go-to girl because I knew everything about the club, who was injured, how long they'd be out for. And I loved doing that so much that I didn't even care that I wasn't on screen or anything. But after 6 months, they started to send me out to do reports of training, which I just loved, to go and watch Real Madrid train. And then the next season, you know, people move on, and I started to move up. And by the end of it, in my seventh season, I was the senior reporter there and travelling the world with the team and first choice to interview the first team. And, you know, it just goes to show if you knuckle down and work hard, anything's possible.
What were Madrid like to work for? What were the players like? Who did you get on best with?
The funny thing is you get on best with all... It's funny because now part of the reason that I was ready to leave a few years ago, but when Mourinho came in, there was no way I was going. You know, I really wanted to be working under Jose Mourinho, so I stuck around for a little bit longer. But suddenly, there's only, like, I think Carvalho in the current team, and Iker Casillas is the same age as me, who were the same age or older than me. Whereas when I first started, you had the likes of David Beckham and Ruud van Nistelrooy, Cannavaro, Diarra, all these people came in, and they were all older than me. So these were people that, you know, I kind of looked up to a lot more. It's not that, you know, I have a lot of respect for footballers younger than me. Of course I do, but it's a real big turning point. But I will say it was Ruud van Nistelrooy left a huge impression on me. He was somebody who gave his everything to the team. When we used to bring people to meet them, he would spend ages talking to them, particularly if they were from Manchester or Manchester United fans. He had great stories. He told us that he can't even describe how amazing Capello's team talks were. He wouldn't even be able to put it into words, but just something special used to happen in the dressing room. And Ruud van Nistelrooy would just as likely be talking to one of the stewards on the plane or the physio or the kit man as he would be to, you know, like the other big name footballers. He just really embraced the culture. He learned Spanish very quickly and he had time for everybody. And I really love Ruud van Nistelrooy. He's probably the nicest footballer I've ever met.
I went to see him in Madrid in 2008, and because I was writing for Manchester United, he was incredibly helpful and gave us a really good interview. And I agree with you. I think he's a decent bloke. He left Old Trafford in pretty difficult circumstances, and I know that upset him, but he's since built his bridges back with people like Sir Alex Ferguson, and he's kept a place in Manchester. He still goes back to Manchester all the time, and he's loved the fact that he's played for United and for Real Madrid. Did you ever socialise with any of the players, or did you keep it purely professional?
You do generally keep it purely professional, especially at that level, but now and again you do get invited to, like, if there was a leaving do or something like that, because they trust you so much, you get invited because you're working with them on a day-to-day basis. But, you know, you don't see too much. Players at that level, I was talking to someone out here who really knows his football, and he was saying that, you know, it's one or the other, really. You have to either be somebody who doesn't have, you know, that type of separate life of the drinking and the going out. If you want to be at the top of your game, as you'll see with the likes of Ronaldo and Messi, you can't be someone who's going out, you can't be someone who's drinking. And so because I was working with all, like, these athletes who are at the top of the game, you'd go out and none of them would be drinking. It would just be all soft drinks. But when people say girls throw themselves at them, they that night were literally throwing themselves. Like, it was like they were flying through the air, trying to get past this rope to get near them. And I just sometimes realised I left early one night when I was at one of the parties because I didn't want to be seen as being one of those girls. And I remember someone sat in the seat where me and my friend were. And Iron Robin, he was out and he didn't seem too interested in it. I think he'd only gone because it was one of the players leaving dues. And he'd seen someone jump in our seat and he'd told them to move, which was really funny. He said, get out of their seat, you're not invited here, and they are, because he'd seen right through it all. Yeah. And it was really nice to see players like that who don't buy all that life and aren't interested by the girls and stuff and, you know, just happy with their families. It was never as exciting as you think. I mean, although, unless you used to bump into Gooty on a night out, then it was always fun.
Well, he definitely loved the nightlife.
He still does.
I got taken out in Madrid after the game last week, and I thought I'd work for 3 or 4 days when all my mates were enjoying themselves. And a mate of mine knows Madrid very well and took us to a club called Momo.
And we
were in there, my brother and I and a couple of friends, and Ronaldo came in, and the attention that lad got, well, you can just imagine what it was like. It was just like the president of the USA walking in, and he had guards looking after him.
And he was even out. You never see him out.
He was with Pepe and Adan, the reserve team goalkeeper.
Yeah.
But a buzz went round, Ronaldo's coming, Ronaldo's coming. And you could see, the psychology of it was fascinating because you could see all the hangers-on and you could see the girls preparing themselves for him to walk through to this section which had been sealed off at the back.
That's it, it's unbelievable. Aziel's a bit of a regular there as well. But you spoke about Ronaldo. I love that all you Manchester United fans still sing his name, because to me, he is the best footballer in the world. I do not even care, and I will argue with anybody. So many people are scared to say what they feel. He gets so much rubbish for saying your actual genuine opinion. I have never, ever seen a professional like it. I've never seen an athlete like it. And I think he should be celebrated. And it's just fabulous that his name still sang at Old Trafford. He's so professional. He's a lot nicer than people think. You know, if he doesn't, everybody wants a piece of him. If he doesn't want to give you an interview after a game, he'll actually have the decency to come and talk to you and say, actually, not today. I'd rather not, but I'll speak to you next week. I think he's a gentleman, and I just think he's a true, true professional. I think he's great. I can't speak highly enough of him.
United fans respect him because he was a brilliant footballer. Why do you think he's better than Messi, or is he?
Because I think Messi's the best in the world at what he does. And but really, I think that Ronaldo, and I know it sounds so cliche, but everybody talks about, you know, he's a more complete player. He is. He's two-footed, for one. He can score with his head. His physical prowess and the speed at which he can run, just everything, the way he can hold off players, the goals and the range of goals that he can score. And people get annoyed when they say he's petulant because something doesn't go his way. He's just the same in a friendly. I absolutely love Ronaldo, and I think he's really honest as well. So I think his character outside of the game, you know, like, he says what he feels. And he came to Ruud Gullit and me after the Ballon d'Or this year, and he said, what do I have to do? You know, what do I have to do? And a lot of people don't know that he said that, but yeah, everything matters to him so much, and I love that he says what he thinks, you know.
So he was gutted on missing out because he played...
I agreed with him I really think he deserved it, and so did Ruud Gullit. We even said so in the FIFA interviews. I just think that was that year it should have been his, because you know what really annoyed me, Andy? Last year when he scored 40 goals, which was the record then, before Messi scored the 50 the following year. Last year when he did that, but they only won the Copa del Rey, everyone was going, no, Real Madrid only won the Copa del Rey. What, you know, you don't get the Ballon d'Or for goal scoring. And then, so Ronaldo is instrumental in Real Madrid winning their first league since 2008. He scores some amazing goals on the way to it. He's carried the team through games like Rayo Vallecano, Atletico Madrid on the way to it. Still scores a phenomenal amount of goals. And then has a good Euros as well with Portugal. And then everyone's saying, oh, Messi should win it. And you're like, but Ronaldo should win it this year. He got to the semis with Portugal. And he was instrumental in Real Madrid winning the league. No, it's not about what he's won with his team. Messi scored 50 goals, and you're like, hang on a minute, last year you were all saying that Ronaldo's goals didn't count, and it's what you win. He just can't win. So many people want to hate him, and it's because, like he said, he's bueno, guapo y rico, he's good looking, and he's rich, and a lot of people are so envious, they can't bear that. But a lot of people do appreciate him for who he is. And if people turned off the blinkers and stopped comparing to Messi and just enjoyed the two players in their own right, you know, they're missing out on one of the best talents we've ever seen by not embracing how good Ronaldo is.
Why don't you reform the girl band and sing Viva Ronaldo, do a mix?
Andy, I think we might be onto something here. Do you want to manage us?
Did you watch the first leg in the Bernabeu?
Well, I wished I was in the Bernabeu for it. You know, the season I leave, they draw Manchester United. I could have spat, but I went to watch it here in Miami with a gang of my football fan friends here.
What do you think?
And there was a mixture of Manchester United and Real Madrid fans there. I think you guys have massively got the advantage now, and so do... It's only by a little bit, but the fans in Spain and the readers of Marca think that Manchester United are going to do it now. I think it was like 55% of the fans think that.
I'm not being drawn into that trap because I went to the Bernabeu in 2000 when United got a draw and went back to Old Trafford thinking that United would win, and Redondo made sure that that didn't happen. And then a couple of years later... Madrid also beat United. So I think United are slight favourites to go through now, but I wouldn't be surprised in the slightest if Madrid went to Old Trafford and scored three.
Would I? You know why as well? Because basically, generally, Jose Mourinho seems to just pip Alex Ferguson in these things. Jose Mourinho is so clever when it comes to knockout competitions. And Real Madrid, even though we've not seen much of it this year because it's just been this weird season... But, you know, they're historically known as the comeback kings. And, you know, it's not coming back from a draw, but the fact that that Manchester United got the away goal. I spoke to one of my Spanish friend journalists the other week for a column I do that you helped me out with as well, Andy, a few weeks ago. And he said that when it comes to Real Madrid and Manchester United, he thinks that Real Madrid rise much better to bigger teams. You know, like the fact that the way they've played against Barcelona over the last year, they need a team like Manchester United rather than, and he wasn't with all due respect, like Schalke or Galatasaray, because, you know, they rise to the big occasions. I just hope we see something similar to what we saw in the first leg, because it was fascinating.
It was. It was really, really interesting. So many different aspects that you can talk about that game, and everyone's well up for the second leg at Old Trafford. Everyone's asking about tickets. Tickets are almost impossible to get hold of if you've not got one, and it's going to be a great European night at Old Trafford. That's a cliche to say that, but I think it will start as that. I don't think United fans will be singing Viva Ronaldo during the match. I hope they won't, because I don't want him to play well. Or then again, could be reverse psychology. You might think, you know what, I'm really relaxed here, I'm not going to play because I don't need to prove anything to anybody. But somehow, yeah. I don't think that's going to happen. So make a prediction for the leg. And who do you want to win? Are you Madrid now because you've worked there? Or just still
this is a really hard thing. Any other day of the week, I'd want Manchester United. But Madrid's just... like Middlesbrough will always be my first team, but... the years I spent with Madrid and the history I know and all the ex-players, right down to the likes of Di Stefano, who I've met, I've just seen, Madrid forever. I'll be a Madridista now, so they will always be my second team.
What if you got offered a job as the main person at Barcelona TV, living in Barcelona?
First of all, I wouldn't go to another club channel, but second of all, I can categorically say that I would never, ever, ever work for Barcelona, no matter what they paid me.
£2 million, you're going to work for Barca.
It's about integrity, and there's absolutely no way that I would sell myself and go and work for Barcelona.
Would you work for Hartlepool TV?
Of course.
That's disgraceful for a Middlesbrough fan to say that.
The two clubs I loved, I've worked for their club channels, but it may have all been a different story had I got that job at Manchester United TV.
Yeah, well, life works in mysterious ways. And the Ballon d'Or, you must have been buzzing when you got to present that. You've gone from selling kettles to giving, you know.
I thought it was a joke. Like, I just absolutely could not believe it. The first time around when it happened, I was in Sydney, actually, when I found out that it was going to happen on holiday. And I actually could not believe that it was happening. And even till I actually flew out to Zurich to do it, I was still thinking, no, something's going to happen here and they're going to say that they're going to go with somebody who they already know, who's done it before.
Why do you think you got the gig?
I got the gig because basically, this is quite interesting how it all began. I was going to present it with Ian Wright in the beginning, and then Ian Wright pulled out.
Why?
Basically, Ian Wright's old agents represent me in England. And so when they'd come in for Ian Wright, they said, well, we've got a girl for you as well. They said, she's bang on top of a European footballer. She's fluent in Spanish. So they were really interested. And they sent my showreel and they said, yes, she's perfect. So that's how it happened. But then Ian Wright pulled out because there was it was when there were some of the racism issues with FIFA or some of Sepp Blatter's comments.
Okay.
And Ian Wright took, yeah, I mean, I can't say for what Ian Wright did, whether it was right or wrong, but basically he just went to the Sun newspaper and said that unless Sepp Blatter apologises for these comments, I will not present this award. So it was like, okay, what happens to me now? And then they decided to keep me and find another person to present it, and they, you know, got a former winner in Ruud Gullit, who absolutely made the first show for me. He was just a pleasure to work with. He made it really easy for me. And he even said, you know, I'm used to being a pundit, but I don't do a lot of presenting on these style shows, so you're going to be helping me as well. And because I felt like we were really in it together, I just think that's why it went so well the first time, that now he's like, he was a real partner for me the second time we did it. So, you know, that's another thing, like, things can happen, like as you said, and, you know, it would have been Ian Wright. They ended up keeping me on anyway and taking a chance on me, and it worked out. So to be asked back was, like, I never expected that. And the best thing about the Ballon d'Or is all the people you get to meet, because presenting the ceremony is amazing, but afterwards, you know, it's so much more relaxed. You're in the dinner afterwards, you get to talk to everybody. And I know that Sport newspaper in Barcelona put a picture out saying that Ronaldo, Brazilian Ronaldo, Ronaldo's party after the Ballon d'Or, and there's like me, Ronaldo, Ruud, Shevchenko, Christian Carambo, Ruud's manager, and a guy who's like friends with Jose Mourinho. And it wasn't Ronaldo's party at all. It's just that after the Ballon d'Or, we all go to the hotel bar where we all stay, where FIFA put us all up, and everybody just has a few drinks there. But Sport newspaper made out that Ronaldo had had this big wild party. But it's a cool picture anyway, I'll say that.
Would you rather have been with them people or the cracking Middlesbrough side from 1989 with Pallister and Mowbray at the back?
Oh, definitely the cracking Middlesbrough side. I love chatting with Paul. I've spoken, I've mates with Tony Mowbray. I think he's a great guy. And I spoke to him just a couple of months back when I was in Middlesbrough. Gave me an interview and he had a chat and he was asking how I was doing. And I just just growing up being a Middlesbrough fan there, that I can just imagine all the crack and all the stories would have been amazing there. And all in my own accent as well.
So when have you changed your accent?
Tiny bit. I round my vowels off. Although if I go home to Middlesbrough and then come back, I think people need like to press 888 and get subtitles because I've picked up the Middlesbrough accent so strongly.
Tell me your best ever.
Don't make me do a first 11, Andy. I hate them. I usually sit down and have to take about 10-15 minutes when I even decide them.
Tell me five of your best players from Middlesbrough off the top of your head in the strongest Middlesbrough accent you can do.
All right, I'll do it in like. Because there's loads of people from Middlesbrough that talk like that. And they say purple shirt instead of purple shirt. And I can't say yeah. I have to say yeah. That's the way that we say this year. So, Janinho. I don't even know, this is so hard.
Bernie Slaven.
Bernie Slaven. Bernie. Not Bernie. Get it right.
Pallister, Robson.
Yeah, it's like, it's so hard because I like players for different reasons. Like, I loved Frank Cadrew, when he was with us, because he just played with all heart. And now, like, I'm just, like, loving George Friend at the moment. Georgie Friend. But I hate having to pick, like, top 11s and just having to pick, like, top players because I always find it really difficult.
You've done well enough. You've got to do the rest of this interview. We've only got a minute left now in the strongest Middlesbrough accent possible. Are you going to...
I'll put my dirty purple working shirt on and I'll say you're joking, aren't you?
Are you going to present the Ballon d'Or next year when Robin van Persie wins it?
Well, I hopefully will present it next
year. I said in a Middlesbrough accent.
I hopefully I'll present it next year. No, but I'll definitely not present it for this interview in this accent. But I don't think Robin van Persie's going to win it, like.
Why do you think he's going to win it?
Next year?
Yeah, Ronaldo.
I don't think there's anyone yet that I could say. I think it all depends.
I'll make a prediction. Van Persie scores the winning goal at Old Trafford and that propels him to the level in which he's considered for that side. I don't know whether he'll win it or not, but I think he could be in the world's best 11 for 2013. Thank you very much for your time, Kate. It's been a pleasure speaking to you.
And to you.
Good luck with everything in Miami. And hopefully the team where you've got a soft spot will triumph over Real Madrid.
Hopefully not, but I will always still have a soft spot for them anyway.
So that's it for this issue of the United We Stand podcast. We're working on issue 226 of United We Stand. We've just been sent the front cover, which looks really nice. It's going to come out against Madrid, not Norwich, as previously advertised, because of the way the fixtures have fallen. So it's coming out against Real Madrid. So order your subscriptions now, or download the app from iTunes or through our website, uwsonline.com, if you've got an Android device. We hope to have it available for Amazon Kindle Fire products soon, whatever that means. I'm just reading that from a piece of paper. Until next week, goodbye.